Now the Three Martini Lunch with Greg Corumbus and Jim Garrity.
And welcome, everyone, to the Tuesday edition of the Three Martini Lunch, along with Jim Garrity of National Review. I'm Greg Corumbus of Radio America, and Jim, as usual, a good, bad, and crazy, although the good comes with a little bit of explanation here. March 1st, of course, is when the sequestration cuts kick in, if there's not some sort of stopgap measure passed by both chambers and signed by the president before then, and the president sensing that that's not likely to happen, going out to try and win the PR battle here. And here's just a little bit of what the president had to say this morning from the White House about why the sequester can't go forward.
But nobody should want these cuts to go through, because the last thing our families can afford right now is pain imposed unnecessarily by partisan recklessness and ideological rigidity here in Washington.
What a terrible idea to have these horrific, arbitrary, harsh cuts, as he called them, in the State of the Union. Jim, we learned on Fox News Sunday, though, where that idea came from.
Whose idea was the sequester, and did you ever think that we'd actually get to this point?
First of all, it was the White House. It was Obama and Jack Lew and Rob Neighbors who went to the Democratic leader in the Senate, Harry Reid, and said, this is the solution. But everyone has their fingerprints on this.
So Bob Woodward, hardly a conservative firebrand, once again, as he pointed out in his book, the sequester was Obama's idea. And all he's trying to do in the meantime, it looks like here, Jim, is on the one hand say, why won't Republicans compromise, and then say it's all the Republicans' fault?
Well, first of all, Obama also said today that when he finds the guy whose idea this is, he's really going to let him give him a piece of his mind. And he also really wants to find the guy who signed it into law, because that guy really is to blame, not President Obama. There's nothing like hubris to see Obama starting to come apart for him. He held his press conference today, or sorry, not even a press conference, that infers questions. His statement today with first responders behind him, apparently one of the first responders told the Daily Caller shortly thereafter, I felt like a potted plant. The entire message, of course, Greg, was that this is a crisis. This is a problem. This is a looming deadline just 9 or 10 days away. Which raises the question why Obama spent 3 days golfing with Tiger Woods this past weekend. I think Obama really is used to getting his way, used to getting implausible narratives past the media. And it'll be really interesting because, again, like he'll say how terrible the sequester is, but you know, at some point, Mr. President, how did this happen? It's not like you know the Republicans, when you're taking a nap, rushed into the Oval Office and signed it into law because they would have done a whole bunch of other stuff instead. No, you signed this into law. You signed this into law in mid-2011. So you've basically had a year and a half to come up with an alternative. And remember, right after Election Day, John Boehner came out, much to the frustration of many conservatives, and said, look, revenue is on the table. We need to work out a deal, and he wanted to avert the fiscal cliff. And so we averted the fiscal cliff by a couple of months, but we still have sequestration on the table. And it's going to kick in soon. And I don't think that, you know, look, with 9 days left, I don't think you're going to get any grand bargain alternative. And so there's a part of it, you know, like I know there are some conservatives who think that the sequestration is a disaster because of the deep cuts in defense spending. This does amount to about 2.4% of the federal budget. I mean, this is not the overall budget. This is not a particularly big cut. But you know what? This is the only cuts we're going to get out of this president. And maybe, you know, look, if Obama never put forth any better alternative, so it's time to you know, we've made this bed and it's time for the president to sleep in it. The only thing I can say, Greg, to reassure folks worried about the cuts in the Pentagon, I don't know about you. I feel great knowing Chuck Hagel's going to be on top of this. If there's anybody who could administer cuts carefully and with great forethought, and I think most importantly, preparation. Secretary of Defense Chuck Hagel, he's got this, folks. Don't worry about it.
Yeah, no worries there. And, of course, Obama's the president. Not only did he sign it in 2011, early on in 2012, he vowed to veto any efforts to stop it. It was only in the third debate with Mitt Romney that all of a sudden he decided that, well, these aren't going to happen and decided
it totally wasn't going to happen, yes. You know, now we are 9 days away.
Right. On to martini number two now, and in addition to the national gun control debate that's been playing out here over the last several weeks, many states, of course, considering this as well. We saw the draconian gun control laws coming out of New York, for example. Colorado, the latest to hold debates, and the state house passed magazine capacity limits. They also mandated background checks for private gun sales. But there was also a debate that played out on the House floor about whether folks who legally have concealed carry permits can have them on college campuses, and Democrats don't want them to be able to be carried on college campuses. And here's Democratic State Rep Joe Salazar explaining why women in particular shouldn't be able to conceal and carry on campus.
There are some gender inequities on college campuses. This is true. And universities have been faced with that situation for a long time. That's why we have call boxes. That's why we have safe zones. That's why we have the whistles. Because you just don't know who you're going to be shooting at. And you don't know if you feel like you're going to be raped, or if you feel like someone's been following you around, or if you feel like you're in trouble, and when you may actually not be, that you pop out that gun and you pop around at somebody.
Jim, I don't know what most women believe here, but I'm guessing most would choose a firearm with a knife-wielding potential rapist over a whistle. And I think they probably deserve more credit than to just turn around and fire at anybody randomly walking behind them.
Look, ladies, you might shoot the wrong guy, so you can't have a gun. That's his viewpoint in a nutshell. Now, of course, obviously, because firearms exist. But look, first of all, you look at that and you think, well, it's a good thing the cops don't shoot the wrong people. Except in L.A., where they shot. The scenario that this Colorado lawmaker describes, could it happen? Sure, anything could happen. I myself have always said, look, the reason I came from a pro-gun control perspective to a pro-Second Amendment perspective is, look, even if I don't feel the need for a gun, just because I feel safe in my circumstances doesn't mean that other people are going to feel safe in their circumstances. I'm not a young woman walking alone to her car in a parking garage on a college campus. And, you know, that person in that circumstances may feel more threatened and may be more likely to encounter a violent rapist or mugger or something like that. So by God, gee whiz, why would you tell somebody, we're not going to allow you to own a gun because we think you might shoot the wrong... Look, you might just think you're being raped and you're not actually being raped, which is a... typically cloddish articulation we've come to expect from a lot of politicians. Campaign spot, I write, look, I've never heard of Salazar before, and I don't think you're ever going to hear from this guy again, hopefully. It's a typically idiotic statement. Lawmakers make idiotic statements all the time. I'm not really sure why his statement is, we're a relative media blackout compared to, say, Todd Akin or Richard Murdoch. It's one of those things where if you want to say, oh, it's just some yokel down in Colorado speaking off the cuff and sounding like an idiot, fine, but let's have a uniform standard for this. I don't know if Salazar is a across-the-board idiot or he just sounded stupid talking about this issue. I think it's just a good general rule that if you're a politician and you're a man and the topic of rape and rape victims come up, it's a good time to be circumspect. It's a good time to hold what's that old saying? Better to hold your tongue and let the world think you might be an idiot than to open your mouth and reveal that you are, some variation of that. I think he comes across as an insensitive clod. Allegedly, he's already apologized, and in the media world, that's all a Democrat needs to do. We will see if there's any further ramifications of this. But again, I think it just kind of comes to this. You talk about the ultimate example of know-it-all government. A lawmaker is totally convinced, look, I know about these circumstances, and ladies, I just can't trust you with a gun. You're just too dangerous. Never mind the rapists who might be out there.
Yeah, just pathetic. But the Democrats look like they have the edge out there in Colorado. We'll see what happens there. And, of course, what happens here in Washington as the debate moves forward. On to martini number three now, as we obviously focus on Chuck Hagel's confirmation and so forth. John Kerry was easily confirmed, which means there's an open Senate seat in Massachusetts. We know that at this point it looks like it come down to the Democratic primary between Ed Markey and Stephen Lynch, two longtime members of Congress. Markey's really been there a long time. And the assumption is, at least at this point, is that Markey is likely to win. So therefore, State Senator Catherine Clark has decided she's running for Congress if the seat opens up. And Jim has reported on this in the Morning Jolt, Jim. And in addition to the fact that she's already making public that she's going to run for a seat that is not vacant, she's the third person to do so.
Yeah, and obviously these sorts of things happen all the time in politics, but I very rarely do you see the formal announcement that is conditional. I am running as long as the seat opens up. It all depends on how the primary shakes out, which is kind of an awkward, come support me, maybe. Come, I need your support, or I might need it sometime later if Markey loses the primary. I'm sure she's going to come out and loudly endorse Markey. She'll say, look, he will be a great senator, and also it'll open up a job for me. So it's kind of a strange set of circumstances. You always see these kinds of, well, if that seat opens up, maybe I'll run for it, but if that guy doesn't, you always see this thing. It probably says something about the churning ambitions of Democratic politicians, that they don't even wait for the primary. It's, you know, one of those things, look, I'm getting prepared. There's a, you know, if he wins, I'm in. If he doesn't win, then I'll just, you know, every morning come by and say, how you feeling? You feel like retiring? Feeling sick? You need to step down? You know, it's a dog eat dog world in Massachusetts politics.
Yeah, and there used to be some deference. You know, the New Jersey Senate situation, Lautenberg finally announced his retirement, but Cory Booker was basically daring him to make an announcement there.
I would chalk this up to, like, you know, in Massachusetts, you had Ted Kennedy, who was there forever, and no Massachusetts Democrat was ever going to challenge Ted Kennedy.
Right.
And then you had John Kerry there for decades. So you had, like, several decades worth of pent-up ambitions by Massachusetts Democrats that is just bursting forth here. And they really can't wait. Oh, there might be a seat opening up. Like, out of my way. Now, obviously, in a one-party state, you know, you're going to get these kind of nasty primaries.
Mm. Interesting that they all cleared the field for Elizabeth Warren then. But they get their chance now, it looks like. Jim, fascinating as always. We'll talk to you tomorrow.
See you tomorrow, Greg.
Jim Garrity of National Review. I'm Greg Corumbus of Radio America. Please join us again on Wednesday for the next 3 Martini Lunch.